In painting the Mona Lisa, was Leonardo da Vinci aware he was using a mathematical formula commonly called the divine proportion? Artist and physics professor Bulent Adelaide of the University of Mary Washington suggests da Vinci consciously integrated many principles of math and science into his art, making the Mona Lisa the product of a mathematical construct as well as the result of his painterly eye. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we're talking with Bulent Adelaide. He's the author of Math and the Mona Lisa, which seeks to uncover connections between math and science in Leonardo da Vinci's art.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you?
Art historian Kenneth Clark calls Leonardo da Vinci the most relentlessly curious man in all of history. Tell me a little bit about him.
I think Kenneth Clark is entirely correct. He was quite simply a consummate scientist first, and then a part-time artist. He left behind maybe a dozen paintings. He may have touched 20 canvases, but the supreme artist, as we know him, was a part-time artist at best.
I'm surprised to hear he only touched maybe 20 canvases.
Well, art historians often say painting may have just been too simple for him. I don't think so. He painted only three women, 15 years apart, the Ginevra in Washington, D.C., the Cecilia Gallerani, the lady with an ermine, and the Mona Lisa. And you would think that anyone who picked up a brush 15 years apart would be sort of rusty. But each time he comes with new vengeance and new wisdom.
Who do you think the Mona Lisa is?
I agree with a new book by an Italian teacher who spent 28 years going through Florentine libraries. There was a Lisa. She was married to La Gioconda, who was a merchant, a good friend of Leonardo's father, who was, of course, a notary. And Leonardo did the painting for no reason, probably. Then it was a family friend. He had pressure from his father. But he never parted with the painting. He kept it with him. He kept giving the Gioconda family excuses. He took the painting to France and eventually willed it to Francis I. And of course, it's in France in the Louvre.
Tell me a little bit about his background. He grew up wealthy or no?
He was a love child of a 15-year-old peasant by the name of Caterina and a 24-year-old well-to-do notary. He lived with his mother and a young peasant that the mother married in Anciano, a little village outside Vinci. The father took the child when he was five, the real father, and
The notary.
But when his wife, a well-born wife, so to speak, could not have any children, that's when he took the boy. And at 15, the boy was apprenticed to Andrea del Verrocchio. This was a perfect match. Verrocchio was an artist in Florence who ran a very good bottega, an artist colony or atelier. And Leonardo learned most of the techniques that he would practice and perfect later on.
Such as?
Verrocchio. Well, the sfumata, the smoky, misty air in the distance. This was, in fact, thought to have been introduced by Leonardo. It was most likely introduced by Verrocchio. But then Verrocchio told his pupils to learn from the body from the inside out. But he had no idea to what levels Leonardo would go. He became quite simply the greatest anatomist in history. Unfortunately, he didn't publish. It was 24 years after Leonardo died that Vesalius published a book on the fabric of the human body. And for the first time, realistic anatomical drawings started coming out. Leonardo's were much, much better. There's never been quite anything like them.
Tell me about Leonardo's relationship to that powerful Italian family, the Medici.
the Medici backed him a great deal in the beginning, but then, as they perceived Leonardo to be a procrastinator, they started withholding commissions from him. But Leonardo was always going off to do other things, his scientific interests. And then in 1480, after he had been embarrassed by a terrible scandal brewing in Verrocchio Atelier about gay behavior, so to speak.
Leonardo was gay?
Leonardo may have been gay. Most likely he was gay. Or it may have been sublimated sexual energy, according to Freud, that drove him to such great creativity. If this is true, it would also explain Isaac Newton, another one of these transformative geniuses. Among geniuses, even, there's this stratosphere of the transformative genius. In history, I think we've seen maybe 6 or 8, maybe 10.
Name a few.
Shakespeare, Beethoven, people who completely define a field. In art, you can argue about the third greatest artist. It may have been Raphael or Rembrandt. Some might make a case for Picasso. But about number one and two, you take them in either order. Leonardo and Michelangelo are that supreme as drivers and people who influence future generations.
Tell me something else we should know about him. We think of him as a painter, of course, but how else should we know Leonardo da Vinci with his many, you know, he touched so many different other aspects of academic disciplines and was phenomenal.
You're absolutely right. Just before he died, in some very poignant lines, he talked to his assistant Melzi and he said, "Did anything get done?" He wasn't happy with all that he had done, but he left an amazing body of notes, the codices, and you find that he's inventing the future. Not only those inventions of planes and cars and spring-powered automobile, the bicycle. But he has the fundamental science, the anatomical studies, then physics, something that physicists would rarely know about.
Let's talk just about the inventions, for instance. Did he actually invent anything that he then made and brought to fruition, or were later designers and engineers the people who built things that he conceived of?
Most of them, in fact, were mental creations, mental inventions, so to speak, theories. The flintlock or the wheel lock was something that did come to fruition in his time. In fact, he had been doing experiments with locks, and he connected the lock to a stock and a barrel, and he had lock, stock, and barrel.
Ah.
And this is one of the true fruitions of his time. So are the scissors. That's Leonardo da Vinci.
Really?
My question there is whether he made them left-handed scissors or right-handed, because after all, he was completely left-handed.
Are you?
No, not at all. I'm very jealous of left-handed Italians, but I'm not. But you see, as you look at his drawings, especially as a scientist looking at the drawings, I can see how his mind was darting around from project to project, and all of a sudden these would come together and another miracle would be born.
He kept meticulous notebooks about his work and observations. Have you read all the surviving notebooks? What percentage has survived?
Well, there are about 4,000 pages left from the original 14,000 pages thought to have been created. I've gone through all the codices that are left behind, the facsimiles. The original pages cost millions of dollars now, or they're worth millions of dollars.
And are kept where?
In different places. Florence has a large set, over 1,000. It's called the Atlanticus Codex. The Queen has a large set. Bill Gates bought at a public auction or a secret auction a very small notebook called the Leicester Codex for $33 million.
What about the popular thriller, The Da Vinci Code? Surely you've read it?
I have read The Da Vinci Code. It's a very good thriller. It's a formula thriller that goes behind just the romance. There is some romance in it, but there is the allusion to this great genius, the great art. There is murder, and there's religion.
Did you like it?
I did like the book. I thought the ending was a little bit weak. I don't know about the truth of it, but I do know that there's one thing Dan Brown would have included had he known it. Leonardo, very much like a Hollywood casting director, would go around looking for the ideal faces for this great painting, for The Last Supper. He found Christ quite simply. He had an easy time with Christ. He was a handsome, pious-looking man. He started painting him. He put him into the great mural. And Judas was one of the later discoveries for him. He knew what he wanted, but he couldn't find the exact Judas. Finally, a friend of his came to him and told him about a perfect Judas in a Roman prison. Leonardo dutifully went to the Roman prison and agreed this was his Judas. And the man agreed, and as Leonardo sketched him, made detailed sketches for his painting, the man said, you don't recognize me, do you? Leonardo suddenly recognized him and started shaking. This was his Christ 3 years earlier. The same person had posed for Christ that would pose for Judas.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Bulent Adelay, a professor of physics at the University of Mary Washington and the author of a new book, Math and the Mona Lisa. In your book, Math and the Mona Lisa, you attribute some of Leonardo's enduring and universal appeal as an artist to this mathematical expression. What is it called? The divine proportion. There are many names.
The divine proportion, the golden ratio. Leonardo actually illustrated a book published in 1509, and he shows that he knows these polyhedra, these mathematical formulas, and he has real interest in mathematics.
Was he formally schooled?
He had no formal schooling. This is the amazing thing. The message of my book is a holistic education, that artists should know music and science, that scientists should know art and music, and the humanists should know everything in between science and art. In any event, Leonardo himself was an unlettered man. He didn't have a single day of schooling. All his notes are written right to left, backwards. But this is not because he was being secretive. Most likely, he didn't want to smear the ink. He was left-handed. You can tell by the shading in a drawing, in a sketch. If it has a positive slope, that is, if it rises to the right, it's a right-handed artist. If it rises to the left, it's a left-handed artist.
Yes.
American ties that are striped are all striped downwards to the right. European ties are all right-handed slopes.
How do we come to be this way, we Americans?
It's not quite clear. I did hear a very good talk about this, but the word sinister comes from left.
Right, left-handedness.
And Leonardo, this jumble of contradictions, living in a right-handed world, was left-handed, and he had never been pressed by a poor first-grade teacher to write with his right hand from left to right.
So let's explain what this golden ratio is.
The golden ratio comes from a rectangle that's approximately 3 by 5, like an index card, or 2 by 3, like a post-it note. But more precisely, it's the shape of the Parthenon, 1 to 1.618. As an aesthetic, the ratio was known. 2,000 years earlier, the pyramid builders, the Egyptians, used the ratio. So its appeal to us as a natural shape is unquestionable.
How do we see it in the Mona Lisa?
In the Mona Lisa and the other two paintings, the ladies, you find that the head down to the bodice does create this rectangle. That is, if you take the head to be in a square of height, one head in a sense, and extrapolate it downwards, extend the square downwards 62%, it goes right through the bodice in all three paintings. If you draw diagonals for the square, you find that it goes right through an eye. I should say, a vertical bisector of the painting invariably goes through one of the eyes. Artists are never taught this. But if you look at the great portraits and draw a line right through the middle, you find that it goes through an eye. in Rembrandt's self-portraits, all those dozens of paintings, right through the eye. In the Mona Lisa, right through the eye. And even Picasso. Picasso, if he had known this principle, would probably have put the eye in the lower right-hand corner somewhere. But you find in portrait of Dora Maar, one of his great masterpieces, the line goes right through the eye.
Won't most scholars say that even in Leonardo's case, it's inadvertent?
This would be inadvertent. The shape, the golden rectangle, in most people, I would think, would be inadvertent. 99.99% of artists who use it most likely use it because it looks just right. These are nature's numbers in the sense that they appear in trees, in flowers. They present themselves as subliminal messages to us. And the artist picks up on these. It's not that any artist goes around counting the branches, but it looks right. And that's what the artist paints. It looks right. In Leonardo's case, he goes beyond that. There's a certain optical illusion operating in the Mona Lisa. If you look directly at the Mona Lisa's mouth, straight on, there is no smile. If you look with your peripheral vision at the mouth, the smile comes back. This is an optical illusion. And this is something that can be demonstrated by neurophysiologists with all kinds of patterns. He didn't paint anymore after the Mona Lisa. I mean, he sketched a great deal. So this principle that he had invented, that he had imbued the great painting with, there is that optical illusion. There's one other optical illusion in the Mona Lisa. The background, the horizon, is not level behind her head. It's slightly higher on the left side than on the right side. You're unsettled a little bit when you look at the Mona Lisa. You scan back and forth across her eyes inadvertently. That's part of the mesmerizing effect. The central line principle, for example, if you look at the pictures that you've taken of family members, it has to be a single person portrait. It most likely goes through an eye, not through the nose.
And remind us again of how we get to the central line you're referring to.
Well, you draw a line that bisects the painting vertically, straight down. And the face, you would never turn right at the camera. You turn it slightly one way or the other. That one line goes through an eye in 1/3 of all great portraits, and it goes within 5% of that line within 2/3 of all paintings. So the artist seems to focus on an eye. You communicate with an eye, not with both eyes, on one eye. It could be the leading eye, the one turned towards you. It could be the receding eye, the one that's farther away, but it's through one eye.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating stuff.
So you're saying he had a scientific eye and an artistic eye, and you've also surmised that he had an extraordinary eye, superhuman vision.
Well, preternatural vision. I think this is one way that he differed from most of us. Ted Williams was the last person I can think of who seemed to have preternatural vision. Ted Williams used to say he could see the seams on a baseball coming at him at 90 or 100 miles an hour.
Did he mean that?
Most likely. I asked a Harvard neurophysiologist once, and I asked him about that, and he said it may be because they have great distant vision, that they can focus much earlier.
Now, why do you think Da Vinci had this great vision?
In several places where he shows, for example, the flapping of wings, he drew an entire notebook of dynamic birds' wings in air. He shows how the wing moves. You have to be able to freeze motion in your mind, in a sense, to draw it this way.
No, he just have a dead bird and move its wing up and down.
No. He shows these wings in their serial motion of birds flying. So he did have understanding. Whether this preternatural vision really exists or not, I don't know. I'm told that some NASCAR drivers, for example, can read the labels on records, the old records, the 33 1/3 RPM records. I certainly can't.
As they're turning.
That's right, as they're turning. Yes, yes. Maybe even 78s. Maybe Leonardo could have read the 78 RPM.
Well, as with so many people, do you think that Leonardo da Vinci's genius was recognized in his time as it is now?
The science was not recognized. The art was. Vasari, his earliest biographer, says, if Leonardo did only science, he would probably have been a great scientist. Well, Vasari has no idea of how great a scientist Leonardo is. He essentially asked questions that Galileo asked on gravity, and then Isaac Newton asked, and then finally Einstein asked. This is a 500-year-old epic story of how gravitation was finally understood.
Do we know whether any of those subsequent geniuses had read his notes?
Most likely, no. There might have been some stories, and Galileo, in doing the experiment from a tower, dropping bodies. Bodies in physics means just objects. In the Renaissance, you had to take it more seriously. This is the time of the Borgias and the Sforzas. They really did drop objects, bodies from, or soon to become bodies,
right,
from tall towers. But both of them discovered the constant acceleration. It's a remarkable, remarkable discovery. Isaac Newton finally explained it with his laws and with calculus, that this acceleration is constant.
Do you think we'll ever see another Da Vinci, a man accomplished in as many areas?
I would never want to say never, but it's unlikely that we'll ever see anyone quite as good in so many different fields. I certainly believe in cross-semination of fields. In fact, this is the entire message of my book. In the manner of Leonardo, take from science and put it into the art and vice versa. He was the finest artist doing science, so he could do those drawings of the anatomical studies. It was illegal to do anatomical studies, to do postmortems. He had to visit morgues and hospitals where he did this. And there's one very, very poignant story. He visits a very old man in a hospital. And in speaking to the old man, he says, "How old are you?" The man says, "Very old." And Leonardo says, "Well, how old?" And the man says, "Well, I don't know, but my grandson is 58. And Leonardo immediately computes that the man is at least 100 or well over 100. And he's holding the man's hand, comforting him, when the man suddenly passes away. Within a few hours, Leonardo is doing a post-mortem. He wants to understand how anyone can die such a sweet death. Well, a few weeks later, he does a post-mortem on a child, a young boy. Then he explains in his notes, he says, in the case of the old man, the blood vessels leading to the heart were occluded, the blood vessels were brittle. In the case of the young boy, they were clear and supple. He's describing atherosclerosis, arteriosclerosis, 500 years ago, 400 years before it was identified in medical schools in Vienna. So this is what I mean by his discoveries that never got into the hands of other scientists.
It's not clear to me why he's allowed to cut into dead bodies, given his profession.
Well, he probably paid people to do this. And later, in his 50s, in fact, he collaborates with a great anatomist at Padua, the University of Padua, Marcantonio Torelli, I think. He learns some better techniques in doing the anatomical drawings. And his drawings are much better in this period, in the early 1500s, than they are in the 1490s, for example, when he's doing postmortems in Milan. Incidentally, in Milan, working for the Sforzas, he was working as a military engineer. This bundle of contradictions that he is, he's a pacifist working as a military engineer. And on the side, he creates one or two truly great works of art, the miraculous paintings, The Virgin of the Rocks, which also is cited in the Da Vinci Code, and the Last Supper. The Last Supper is a great psychological study. The Virgin of the Rocks, to me, it's the composition that's very interesting. The background are these caves. His love of geology comes through. But then the bodies themselves, the quartet of figures, the Virgin Mary, the infant Christ, the infant John the Baptist, and the angel are all in a pyramid. Just by chance now, the pyramid has the same shape as the precise pyramid the Egyptians used, the one with the golden ratios. It's almost as if he's discovered it all on his own, this precise shape.
His genius was manifest in so many different arenas. Do you think we've lost our capacity for that now? We're now no longer a society of generalists, but of specialists. We're not encouraged, and we feel a little defeated at the prospect of trying to be expert, perhaps, in more than one thing. We're competitive.
I think one problem is that there's so much more to know now. The children know far more than we do about computers, for example, or they can experiment with them much easier. I opened my book in the prologue, in fact. I mentioned C.P. Snow, an English scientist and writer, who in 1959 gave a talk at Cambridge, and he talked about the two cultures, the culture of the scientist and the culture of the humanist. And some of the humanists, the writers there, jumped on him, and they said, science is no culture. Well, what even C.P. Snow didn't understand was we were right at the threshold of a third culture, the information age, the computer age. There are now three sectors in this division, and there are very few bridges, unfortunately. The scientist rarely gets to speak to the artist, and the artist to the scientist. And the computer scientist, who is certainly the architect of this third sector of the pie, is not a natural scientist, and he's not a humanist. And yet, more bridges have to be built across these cultural divides and the cross-semination of ideas to be used more effectively.
Beulah Dadalet, thank you for sharing your insights on Leonardo da Vinci with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, Sarah.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile?
Beulah Dadalet is a professor of physics at the University of Mary Washington. He's the author of Math and the Mona Lisa and is himself an accomplished artist. You're listening to With Good Reason. Nancy King and Elliot Majerzik are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Amy Marshall is our publicity coordinator. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, for the Higher Education Broadcasting Consortium, and public radio station serving Virginia. For a free copy of this show on CD or to comment, call 877-451-5908 or visit us on the web at withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Do you smile to gentle lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Or just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art?